This is Richard Verone. I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Robert Fisher. Today is March 20th, 2003. It's approximately 8:37 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the interview room of the Special Collections Library. Colonel Fisher, you are in Marco Island, Florida. Let's start, sir, with a brief biographical sketch of yourself. Could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Okay, I was born in Abington, A-B-I-N-G-T-O-N, Abington, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
September 30th, 1937. And I grew up in that area, mainly around a town called Doylestown, D-O-Y-L-E-S-T-O-W-N, one word.
Okay.
And I spent most of my my youth there. We moved around a couple different places, but I graduated from high school in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty much a pretty active athlete. I played all sports, plus I was a swimmer from the time I was 5 years old. And so I was pretty much outdoors type most of my life.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, I went to Lehigh University, studied engineering for a full year, and halfway through my year, I heard about the United States Air Force Academy, which was only 1 year old at that point. And I always wanted to fly, so I made application to the academy, took all their tests, and I qualified, and I was accepted to the academy, and I entered the academy in, let's see, I guess it was July. Yeah, it was July 1956.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple questions about growing up in Pennsylvania. Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
One brother, one sister, both older.
Okay. And what was Abington like? Was it a relatively small town or that area you grew up in?
Abington was only the hospital where I was born,
town.
I grew up in Doylestown pretty much, or just outside of Doylestown. It had about 12,000 people at the time, and it's the county seat of Bucks County, which is a pretty famous county in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
So it was very active. There was a good cross-section of people there.
Okay. You said you were active in sports and active as a child. Was this something that you did immediately as soon as you got old enough? You started participating in sports, and you said you were swimming by age five?
Yeah, I swam competitively from about age eight up until I was about, I guess, 14 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, up till 18, I swam my first year at the academy, too.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay. Tell me about your parents. What did they do?
My parents were both born in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
My father was born near the Austrian border and in Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
And he emigrated to the United States in, about 1923.
Mm-hmm.
And he came here, learned English, and I think he had about an eighth grade education, but he left his home because there was no future there for him at that point in time.
Okay.
And my mother was born in Stuttgart, and she came to the United States with her family when she was 16. That would have been 1922.
Okay.
And they met here and got married, and then my dad was working as a truck driver. And he ultimately started his own business in 1927, and he retired 50 years later, and he retired with his own business.
Okay. What kind of things was he hauling around?
He was an agent for United Van Lines.
Okay.
So he was in, he had about 10 men working for him most of the time, and he had a moving and storage business, and he also hauled milk from the farmers to the dairy.
Okay. Did your mother work?
No, she didn't work. She did a lot of volunteer work, but she was basically a household mom.
Okay, okay. Tell me about your childhood. Did you work in your childhood?
Did I work? Oh, yeah, I worked from the time I was 14 or so.
I
think the first year I raised corn cantaloupe because I was too small to drive and really work for anybody, too young. And then the next year I worked for a farmer the whole summer, and the following year I had three jobs. I think I worked for a contractor, I drove a truck for my dad, and I hauled milk in the morning, worked on the moving truck in the afternoon, and I was a lifeguard a couple times in the evening.
Okay. Yeah, I bet you were a pretty good lifeguard since you were such a great swimmer.
Yeah, I love that. I love being near the water.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about you academically. What kind of student were you growing up?
I guess I was above average. My senior year, I finally got serious, and I graduated probably in the top tenth of my class from high school. Our class was about 240 kids, I guess. And I was in the honor roll and all that good stuff. And my year at Lehigh really enabled me to, I think, succeed at the academy because it really prepared me well. That year of engineering with all the math and the tough courses, the calculus, the separator courses, it enabled me to do very well at the academy.
Right. What were your favorite subjects in school?
I liked math a lot. I was in some advanced math programs, and I represented the school in a couple deals where you go down to and take an exam on behalf of your high school. I also liked history a lot, and I liked English. I was fairly balanced.
Okay. Did your parents push education to you and your siblings? Was this something that kind of you were expected to go to college?
No, not really. I was the first one in my family to go to college, and I just kind of did it on my own, I think. My parents, I don't think, ever once looked at my homework. But they did encourage me. I mean, my brother quit high school and really never went back to school, which was a shame. My sister went through high school and then through art school, and she was a very accomplished artist. She was married. But I was the first one in my family to go to college.
Okay. Do you have any memories of World War II?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Tell me about those. What do you remember about that time?
I can remember asking my parents who we were fighting, the Japanese or the Germans. I was very confused because I thought we were fighting the Germans, and I found out we were fighting the Japanese. And I was confused by that, but... I think I figured that out after a while, and I don't obviously have any specific memories of Pearl Harbor. I was only 4 years old.
Right.
I guess by the time I was in elementary school, I remember my mother never taught me any German because she was afraid I would get into a problem in school. But I later studied German, and I'm fairly fluent in German now.
Okay. Did your parents, being from Germany, did they experience any backlash at all?
No, not that I know of, but my parents were pretty close-mouthed, pretty private, and we never discussed stuff like money, or at least not with me. I'm sure they did, but I never really understood, you know, a lot of the things. I guess as a kid, I just kind of put one foot in front of the other.
Okay. So when you get to Lehigh, did you study specifically engineering and math? Was this your kind of course of study that you had chosen?
It was the freshman year of engineering.
Okay.
It was the base courses. I mean, it included all the way up through calculus.
Okay.
And a lot of... I also had a great English, believe it or not, in engineering school. It was all men. I had a great English professor there, which I really enjoyed.
Okay.
It was like a little respite from all the technical courses.
How did you hear about the U.S. Air Force Academy?
I found it in a brochure when I was in a restaurant one night. We went down to eat dinner, my roommate and I. And I just happened to stumble across it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the way it happened.
That's incredible. So when you read the brochure, what turned you on? What made you want to go to the Air Force? You said you had wanted to fly.
Yeah, I always liked flying. And what I read about the academy, they had very high academic standards. They were just a brand new academy, and it was in Colorado. I always loved the West, so I thought, gee, why not give it a shot?
Now, where did your desire to fly come from?
I don't know. I had flown a couple times with some boyfriends of my sister. They took me up for a ride here and there, but I just always enjoyed. I like mechanical things. I've always been very mechanical, and flying was kind of a natural thing for me to pursue, I think.
Okay. Did any of your family members serve in World War II?
No.
Okay. So your family had no real military experience up to this point?
No, that's right.
Okay. Well, tell me about when you left Lehigh and you went in the summer of 56, went out to Colorado Springs. What was that like for you?
Okay. I went to Denver, not Colorado Springs.
Okay.
The first academy, academy was at Denver, not Colorado Springs. We didn't move there until I was going into my junior year or second class year.
Okay.
But we were stationed at Lowry Air Force Base, and they had a lot of temporary facilities set up there. They were pretty basic, pretty simple, but they are obviously very clean and well-maintained. It was kind of a shock to me. I'd never gone through anything quite like that before.
This was your basic training?
Well, the freshman summer. It was very physical. I think I weighed about 157 pounds, and my normal weight even in high school was like 165.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was very physical, and I'm a pretty physical guy, so I kind of liked that. That was not a problem for me. And I think it made me appreciate what they were trying to prepare me for.
Mm-hmm.
They were making you reach down and develop some character traits that would, you know, withstand you under duress.
Mm-hmm.
So the freshman was a lot of different subjects, everything from shooting various kinds of weapons. We had judo, I think, boxing. We had marksmanship. We did a lot of running, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
We had some academic courses. I remember they would march us over to the theater on Sundays, a little wooden theater, and they would show us movies about the Air Force.
Okay.
So that they indoctrinated us, basically,
mm-hmm.
and tried to interest us more in the history of the Air Force, where it came from and why we were privileged to be there.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you felt about all of that?
I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I never once my whole time there did I have a feeling that I wanted to leave.
Hmm.
A lot of guys did.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fortunate, I guess. I just felt committed. I felt like I was in the right place. And I when I started the academics, I realized how high a quality of academics and teaching there were.
Mm-hmm.
Our classes were like maybe 10 of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were quite small. Our instructors, professors were military people, but they were very well qualified, very well educated.
Mm-hmm. How did you do academically?
I did well. Let me see. I think I was 20 something out of my class. We started with 306 and graduated 227.
Okay.
So I was in the top 10% or so.
Okay. Now, when did you first get the opportunity to fly? Was this after your freshman year? Did they put you in an airplane then?
During the 4 years we were there, we went through navigation training, not pilot training.
Okay.
We had a separate course. Mm-hmm. We started, I guess, as sophomores, and then we flew for about 2 or 3 years
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis, and we learned how to navigate.
Okay.
And after graduation is when you go to pilot training. So they didn't try to compress pilot training into a shorter course for us. We attended that if we qualified after graduation.
Okay. Did you graduate in 1960?
Yes.
Okay. How would you rate the training that you received overall there at the academy?
Excellent. I couldn't think how it could be any better.
Okay. Okay.
That was one of the reasons why I was so positive about the place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though you were worked and you had very few privileges the first couple of years,
mm-hmm.
I was committed. I wanted to do well, and competition was a thing of the. I was constantly in presence there because you were actually graded periodically. You took actually small exams almost 3-4 times a week
mm-hmm.
in classes, and then you had quarterly exams, and then you had semester exams and finals, and you were actually put into sections. So, like, if we were in let's say chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, because I had had a year of college, I was able to validate what they called general chemistry, and I went right into quantitative and qualitative chemistry my freshman year,
mm-hmm.
which is normally taught, you know, later on in a college curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into some advanced algebra and calculus and vector algebra courses. I also was able to study German for about 6 semesters. I studied Spanish for 1 semester and studied French for a semester.
Wow.
So it was what was neat is that we were able to help develop the curriculum.
Okay.
If there were enough of us interested in a particular course that was not offered, they would put together a course and offer it.
Okay.
I mean, that was really being part of the beginning, I guess that was the opportunity that most people never had.
Mm-hmm. That's very unique. Tell me what you think today about the Air Force Academy. You were there in its infancy, and what is your impression about how it's changed over the years?
Well, the recent news isn't so hot.
Yes, sir.
Of the nonsense that's going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
I personally am concerned about them liberalizing some of the things. We held our honor code as a sacred thing,
mm-hmm.
And there were no second chances. If you lied or stole anything or cheated, you were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you were gone so fast that most of the people didn't even realize what had happened. But then they would explain it to you after the individual was gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it had to be a specific case of lying, stealing, or cheating.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other part was you were obligated to report someone if you knew, in fact, or suspected that they had done either lied, stolen, or cheated.
Yes, sir.
And you were obligated to do that. If you didn't, you were just as guilty as the guy who did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, so what's going on today, I'm not pleased with. I belong to the Alumni Association, been a member ever since I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet regularly about once a quarter with other graduates from the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
I travel down to Washington and meet with them. And we get normally a very good update there because there's probably 20 or 30 of us there. And we get some input from all over, different
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm on a website and email, and with the email I'm constantly in touch with what's happening at the academy.
Okay. So you sound very involved.
I am involved. I'm disappointed what's happened because I don't think those things would have happened if they had not liberalized some of their policies.
When you say that, what do you mean? What kind of policies do you think were liberalized?
The Honor Code.
Okay.
They have a second chance now. I don't know what the deal is, but what it actually boils down to is apparently if a kid is found guilty of an honor violation,
mm-hmm.
The parents will sometimes obtain a lawyer and actually challenge this.
Wow.
And I just don't like the whole flavor of it. It's just like, you know, it's a litigious society today, and that's where it begins. And
mm-hmm.
we were more committed and maybe more focused.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't want anybody in our midst that we couldn't trust and depend on.
Right, right. Tell me what your impression was at the time. What did they tell you the role of the U.S. Air Force would be? This is when, you know, obviously at the very infancy of the creation of the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
What were they telling you about that?
To fly and fight.
Okay.
That was it.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they wanted you to be educated, not just technically,
mm-hmm.
but as an officer
mm-hmm.
and a trusted officer who would set the example
mm-hmm.
and live up to those expectations.
What about the Air Force in relation to the other branches? What do they explain the role of the Air Force to be?
I mean, that was fairly clear. We basically always, every one of us, I think, aspired to fly. And of course, after you've flown a number of hours, you have to progress into other responsible roles of commanding a unit.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force basically was one of the services, and our responsibility was to support the other services whenever possible.
Okay.
And it was we also realized the Navy flew, and the Army had mainly helicopters at that time,
mm-hmm.
rotary wing type.
Mm-hmm.
But our primary job was to operate, maintain, and support aviation.
Okay. Personally, what did you want to do with your Air Force career at that point when you're at the academy?
Having been indoctrinated how important education was,
mm-hmm.
I was interested in after-flight training, spending a couple of years on active duty flying, flying the line, and just flying. Basically, that was your primary job.
Mm-hmm.
And after 5 or 6 years, then I intended to go back to graduate school,
okay.
get a graduate degree in something that I was interested in, and then come back into the service and pick up some assignments that were more challenging in a management area
mm-hmm.
than just strictly flying.
Was there any pressure on you to come back home and work for your father?
Oh, no. No, I never aspired to do that.
Okay. How did your parents feel about you being at the academy and in the military?
Sort of like they did in high school. They sort of figured I knew what I was doing and why I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they really ever quite understood what the Air Force Academy was. I think they knew I was in the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they realized that it was as challenging. You know, it was equivalent of a very high-quality four-year college.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever get out to visit you in Colorado?
Yeah. My freshman year, we weren't allowed to go home at Christmas. So my mother came out with another woman, and she was the mother of a good friend of mine from mm-hmm. Pennsylvania that we were both in the same class.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out and spent Christmas out there, and we were allowed to go out to have dinner with them and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So she got a chance to see. That was at Lowry Air Force Base.
Okay.
And then at graduation, my mother and my father came out for the graduation.
Okay. What was that like for you to have them out there when you graduated from the...
I was very proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They love Colorado, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they really liked it.
Mm-hmm. So when you graduated, you said you did go through your basic physical training, weapons training, things like that during your summers. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did you adapt personally to the military discipline?
Easy. It was easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I understood what they were trying to teach me, and I agreed with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't fighting it.
Okay.
I had a couple roommates, one particular who fought it, mainly because I think he struggled academically, and I tried to help him and counsel him and do whatever I could, tutor him. He just didn't have the commitment, I don't think, and he basically left the academy. But all my other roommates were great. Matter of fact, we're still very good friends with just about every roommate I ever had.
I was going to ask you, did you form some special friendships there?
Oh, yeah. The best.
Okay. Were you able to run into them during your career at all in the Air Force?
Oh, yeah. It's a small society. Aviation
right.
is fairly small, and the United States Air Force is an even smaller society.
Right.
And, yeah, I would come across them a lot of times. We'd be in the same unit, or
mm-hmm.
we'd meet in an officer's club, or we'd see each other out in the line or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to almost all the reunions, so I maintain close contact with our classmates.
Okay. Okay. Well, tell me about your first basic flight training. I take it this took place in 1960 after graduation. Did you go down to Florida?
Yeah, I went to Florida.
Okay.
Reported in August of 1960
mm-hmm.
at a place called Bartow, B-A-R-T-O-W.
Mm-hmm.
It's just outside of Winter Haven, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice little airport. Our instructors were civilian instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew two airplanes. The first airplane was called a T-34.
Mm-hmm.
It was a trainer, primary trainer, and that was a single engine, 225 horsepower recip. And then I think we had about 30 hours in that, and then we went into a T-37, which was a twin engine jet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, just like downtown. I mean, we went from a noisy, hot airplane to one that was just, you know, close the canopy, turn on the air conditioning, and it was
right.
like in front of a TV at home.
It
was very, very comfortable.
How did you do flying personally as a pilot?
Good.
Yeah?
I loved all aspects of it. I mean, there's nothing quite as rewarding as knowing that you can take an airplane up, fly it around, do aerobatics. You can fly formation with three other airplanes
mm-hmm.
By yourself and come back and you pitch out and you land together. And, I mean, you just feel like you're part of a significant force, and you're
mm-hmm.
special.
Mm-hmm. Did it come naturally to you?
I guess. Not as natural as some guys, probably, but a lot better than most guys, I
mm-hmm.
think. I think we all struggled. I mean, it's a different world. Have you ever flown?
No, sir.
Yeah, it's a different world, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Very different, and you have to transition to it. I mean, you struggle with anything, all kinds of problems, everything from air sickness initially
mm-hmm.
to maybe you just didn't like it or didn't like your instructor or didn't like the guy you were living with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are all kinds of things, but the idea was that you were mature enough to deal with that.
Right.
And I loved it. I spent, let's say, August through up to Christmas at Bartow, and we graduated. That was considered graduation from primary flight training.
Okay.
Then I got my orders to go to Reese Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to drive home for Christmas. And then I had an old Austin Healey. It was about a six-year-old Austin Healey.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove that all the way out to Reese in the middle of winter.
Wow.
And a Healey is not exactly a good winter car.
No, sir.
But I don't know. I don't have any bad memories. It was all good stuff,
mm-hmm.
Basically. And I reported into Reese in January.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it's like in January in Lubbock?
Yes, sir.
Whew, it was cold.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember it was so cold doing a pre-flight on a T-33.
Mm-hmm.
That was the airplane we flew.
Uh-huh.
And I was so cold, I was shaking. I could hardly read the checklist, you know. And they also, an interesting thing, Richard, is We were the first class of officers that most of these guys had ever put through. They were normally aviation cadets.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they had not been commissioned yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the first class of second lieutenants, and they treated us like cadets again.
Really?
Yeah, and we rebelled a bit at that because mm-hmm. we had been through 4 years of stuff. These guys might have been through a couple years of ROTC, and you know they were trying to treat us like a bunch of lowlife.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of changed after a couple months. I mean, they had us cleaning the latrines and doing crap like that.
Oh, boy.
And we didn't mind doing that stuff, but I didn't feel like we deserved to be doing that stuff.
Right. Right.
We had been there, done that stuff. What we were there for is to learn how to fly.
Mm-hmm.
So treat us like an officer, we'll treat you like an officer, we'll get along fine.
Mm-hmm. These are obviously not civilian instructors.
No, they're all military.
Right.
And they were only maybe, you know, a year ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these guys had graduated from flight training and then became an instructor and came right back to where they had been. They never fired a shot in combat or done squat besides,
mm-hmm.
you know, been at a flying training
right.
base.
Right. How many people were in your class at Bartow?
My class was 62B or 62 Bravo, and I would guess there were maybe 40.
Okay.
Something like that.
How many finished out?
Don't know exactly. Maybe 30.
Okay. And how about at Reese? What were the numbers? Do you remember?
It was probably similar.
Okay.
I really can't tell you with any authority on that.
Okay. When you think back to your training at Bartow, what comes to mind? What do you remember most about that?
Bartow?
Yes, sir.
It was a great time. I was a bachelor driving a sports car and learning how to fly for nothing. And they
right.
were paying me to do it.
Right.
It was quite a transition from being at the academy.
Right, I can imagine.
You know.
I can imagine. And how about at Reese? What do you remember about your time at Reese?
It was cold.
Uh-huh.
And it was a lot more disciplined than Bartow was.
Okay.
We all kind of fell out at Bartow like, man, we finished 4 years, and this way you get treated when you're in the real Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And now you go back to Reese, and they treat you like a cadet again, and you say, what happened, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought I was further along now than I was before, and they treat me lousy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we moved over that, and I happened to have a very good instructor. I had good instructors all the way through.
Okay.
If I had had a ding-a-ling, I probably would have struggled with that.
How important is it to have that good instructor that you can relate to?
Fundamental, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't relate to them and they can't relate to you and you don't like each other, you should ask for an instructor change.
Okay.
There's no reason to jeopardize your career because some guy comes up short as an instructor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're struggling with a lot of things there. When you're learning to fly, you fly every day, maybe twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And you start out with basic stuff, just, you know, you have to memorize a whole bunch of stuff. Now you become sort of robotic almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then you transition into the aerobatics, and you transition into formation and instrument flying, and these are all very special skills.
Mm-hmm.
So you spend one whole year flying almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't like it, obviously... You're getting a full dose of it.
Right.
You better figure out early on that, you know, you want to go somewhere else.
Which of the aircraft that you had flown to this point, the T-34, 37, and 33, did you like the best?
I guess I like the T-37.
Okay.
It was my first jet, and that's where we were able to do a full range of aerobatics
mm-hmm.
and formation. And
mm-hmm.
It was pretty nifty stuff. It was like a sports car, that airplane.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any incidents that happened to Bartow or at Reese that you recall?
Just minor stuff. You'd have an alternator go offline on the T-34, and you get a big red light in the cockpit. You know how to deal. You memorized all this stuff. You knew it by heart, backwards
mm-hmm.
and forwards.
Mm-hmm.
You deal with it and come back in. And with the T-37, I know that we had we were cautioned not to get that into a spin because you could get into what they call a flat spin on the T-37. You couldn't recover from it.
Mm-hmm.
But you did have an ejection seat in the T-37, so it was downtown. I mean, you were flying a pretty good airplane there.
Mm-hmm. Anybody injured in your training that you recall?
I know a guy punched out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what happened, but I don't think he was badly hurt or anything.
Okay.
Just the guys who resigned, SIE they call it, self-initiated elimination.
Okay. Well, how long were you at Reese from January 61 until when?
September. Graduated, I should know the exact date. It was early in September because we got married about a week later.
Oh, okay.
It was about the 14th or something of September, 1961.
Okay. And at that point, according to where you were in rank at Reese, could you choose where your next assignment would be, or did they pick this for you?
No, you got it right the first time.
Okay. What did you want to do?
I forget what I volunteered for. A couple choices. One of the things I knew I was getting married, and I thought, what a great time to go overseas as a young couple.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up flying a transport in Japan.
Okay.
But it was the only neat overseas assignment that was offered. I remember I used that as my criteria rather than the airplane.
Okay.
And we went to Tachikawa, Japan. Spent 3 years there. Had two baby boys born there.
Wow. Okay. So this is, did you go over in fall 61?
After graduation... trying to remember the exact order. I think after graduation from flight training, I think we went through survival training first,
mm-hmm.
Out at Reno, mm-hmm. Stead Air Force Base. Then that was about a month training out in the woods and learning how to survive if you got shot down or had to bail out. And then I went through C-124 training at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
And that was a three-month deal. And that was quite a shock to me because I was used to flying a nice little airplane like
right.
a fighter.
Right.
And all of a sudden I've got this big truck behind me.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I learned a lot, and I flew with a lot of guys that were very, very good pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And excuse me.
Go ahead.
It was very interesting because we flew all over the place.
In the C-124.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about the 124. Describe that airplane to me.
It was a huge airplane. The big doors in the front opened up, and the doors, and it had a like belly doors also with an elevator. You could pull the cargo up on that.
Mm-hmm.
You could haul troops or cargo or both.
Mm-hmm.
And it had four huge engines on it. They were called 4360s. That's a term for the number of cubic inches
mm-hmm.
in it. And it, I think it was like a stack of donuts. There were like four stacks of radial systems,
mm-hmm.
and it was huge. It was one of the biggest reciprocating engines ever that the Air Force ever built,
mm-hmm.
and you had a pretty big crew. You had two flight engineers. You usually had a co-pilot and a navigator and a loadmaster,
okay.
so the minimum crew would be about six people.
Okay.
But we flew formation. We did a lot of airdrops, and I flew all over the Far East with it, including Vietnam, and that was early on in the war.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the war and speaking of Southeast Asia, how much had you kept up with what American foreign policy was doing overseas? Were you into following that, or did you just
yeah.
kind of follow it to where your career might go?
I can't tell you exactly. I think we weren't exposed to the amount of information. I mean, they had the Stars and Stripes, which is a daily newspaper that
right.
that was given that you bought.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you weren't immersed in things like you would be back in the States or anything like today where you had daily television. I mean, you're watching a war on TV here.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I mean, we had a family. I was gone a lot. My wife was trying to keep things together on the home front.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we had two little boys born there, and we almost lost the first one in the Japanese hospital. And
mm-hmm.
it was not easy. I mean, there were a lot of domestic things that you were more focused on at that point in your life, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're there in Japan 62 to 64?
65.
Okay.
March to March, 1962, March to March 1965.
Okay, so it's a three-year tour. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically hauled stuff around Southeast Asia?
Yes.
Okay. What kind of things would you do? Tell me about your typical day and where you would go and what you would carry.
If we left Tachikawa, we probably flew down to Okinawa, a four-hour flight,
mm-hmm.
and we would be carrying a whole bunch of equipment, maybe to support a fighter squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would spend a couple hours on the ground, offload, onload some stuff from Okinawa, and flew down to the Philippines, another four-hour flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd land at Clark Air Base, and then we'd probably go into crew rest. And we go into crew rest for about 15 hours, and then we kept the same airplanes, which was quite unusual.
Hmm.
We didn't swap airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And then next day we would fly over to Saigon or Bangkok,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd spend maybe a week in Saigon or Bangkok, mm-hmm. flying out of there, mm-hmm. Staying in a hotel, but flying all over the country, taking things out to support units throughout mm-hmm. the country.
Okay.
And then we would be hauling passengers back. We could even be hauling litter patients if they needed that. It wasn't a real comfortable airplane, but if it was the only airplane, that's what you used it for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How close were you with your crew? Did you keep the same crew, or did it rotate in and out of the airplane?
You kept the same crew for that particular trip. Our trips averaged maybe 10 days,
okay.
7 to 10 days.
Okay.
And you had the same crew at that time. And then when you go back, you get your minimum crew rest, maybe at 2 days or so. I think it was 1 for 3 with a maximum of 3 days.
Okay.
So if you're going 9 days, you got 3 days crew rest.
Okay. Okay.
And if you're going 12 days, you got 3 days crew rest. Didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
then you'd launch with a different crew.
Okay.
And, of course, I started flying as a co-pilot until I got enough time to qualify, and then I upgraded to aircraft commander.
Okay. Tell me what your first impressions were of Vietnam and Saigon.
Interesting. Beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
Bangkok was a lovely city. And we were a fair amount of Americans were there at that time, but we had our favorite places to go where we could buy jewelry and
mm-hmm.
we would, you know, have a steak. We knew there was a good steak at a particular restaurant. And Saigon was a little different. It was a little iffy at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You were more concerned about security than you were in Bangkok, but it was a dirtier city than Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. The French influence was obvious, and it was just interesting to see all these people and flying in and out of there for a week. You got to know the country pretty well.
Right, right. How much contact did you have with the Vietnamese civilians initially? Did you stay at Tan Son Nhut, or did you actually stay at a hotel downtown?
We stayed in a hotel downtown at that time.
Okay.
Especially if you're going to fly for repeated times.
Right.
In successive days.
Okay.
I don't remember staying at Tan Son Nhut. They really didn't have quarters for us at that time.
What year did you first get into Saigon?
62.
Uh-huh. And you, I guess, flying in and out of there over the next 3 years, what kind of changes did you see?
Well, I could see the buildup.
Right.
And we were carrying a lot of stuff in there. We were carrying ammunition. We were carrying the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
We were carrying just about everything you need to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And from 62 to 65, there was a significant buildup.
Right.
And we were there carrying the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we could see it. Like, I used to fly into Tan Son Nhut, Da Nang, when it was called a PSP runway,
mm-hmm.
pierced steel planking.
Right.
And we would land the airplane on this. It was just like a steel mat.
Hmm.
And you'd land on that, and they have to reverse the engines real hard because it wasn't real long.
Mm-hmm.
And they would offload and unload the stuff, and then off you go. But, of course, by the time I got over there, for my Vietnam tour in 67,
mm-hmm.
Da Nang was two parallel 10,000-foot concrete runways.
Right.
So that was very significant. I mean, I've been flying into Vietnam since 62.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went over there in 67, I knew what to expect.
Right. How did you feel 62, 63, 4, and into 65, flying in a war zone? Did that affect your flying at all?
No, not really. It was kind of exciting, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from guys I flew with. They were transport pilots, but
mm-hmm.
they were highly qualified. We flew in all kinds of weather. We made instrument approaches into some pretty scary places.
Mm-hmm.
Flew into Taiwan, Taipei. There were a lot of mountainous territory, terrain there.
Mm-hmm.
Bangkok was pretty flat. Vietnam was pretty flat, but it was jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew into Laos. I even got into Hong Kong one time.
Where in Laos did you fly into? Vientiane?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I do remember flying into Karachi.
Okay.
And what we were doing there, we either took in or took out a U-2.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was interesting.
Very interesting.
It was a very highly classified mission at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. So do you remember what you carried into Laos?
No, I don't.
Okay. Did you understand personally, or what did the Air Force tell you or what did you gather from other sources what the United States was trying to do in Southeast Asia?
I guess I understood what the general consensus was, that we were trying to support the Vietnamese people, the South Vietnamese people, and prevent them from going communist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we were building up for that purpose.
Okay. What were your views on that? Did you agree with that? Or
yes.
That, okay. Okay.
At that point in my life, I was doing what I was told.
Okay. Okay. How about those around you, your crewmates, and then those in your unit? Were they pretty much out of the same understanding,
yeah.
same feelings?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. Okay.
If you weren't, you would have stood out, believe me.
Really? Okay. Did you ever have any, and during this three-year tour in Japan, did you ever have any incidents in-country in Vietnam? Any time were you shot at? Any incidents on the runways? Any close air calls?
I don't think so. We hit some pretty nasty weather sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But if I was shot at, I don't remember being shot at.
Okay.
Now, when I was stationed there, I remember being shot at.
Right. Did they give you any special instructions? Say, okay, you're flying over South Vietnam. There's a war going on. Here's what you need to do differently.
Yeah, and a good example of that is we had a, I guess it was in the 141 later on, but we had a very high degree glide slope. Instead of the standard 3-degree glide slope or so, it was something like 4.5 degrees. So you were basically coming down a very steep gradient
mm-hmm.
to avoid ground fire. Yeah,
okay.
That was. I think that was more in the C-141. Than, I don't think we did that in the 124.
Okay.
We were fairly... I don't think we were really aware keenly of how tough that was. I mean, as far as... Excuse me just a second. Someone's at the door.
Okay. Okay, sir. Let me ask you, when you got into Saigon and into Da Nang, and I don't know if you had any contact with civilians at all in Da Nang, but in Saigon you were living downtown for a period of time when you were in country. How did the Vietnamese civilians treat you?
Didn't seem to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were careful about where they selected the hotels for us.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't the threat. I know we used to eat in a place called the Floating Restaurant right on the Saigon River.
Mm-hmm.
And that subsequently was blown right out of the water. I mean,
right. Things
were a lot different early on in the war than they were later.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice a change over the years?
Oh, yeah.
As far as their attitude was concerned?
I couldn't specifically say. I mean, they were interested in selling things, and mm-hmm. if you were interested in buying, you were their friends, you know?
Right. Okay. So after your tour in Japan is finished in 1965, did you go back stateside?
Yes, I got an assignment to fly the airplane called a C-141. It's a four-engine swift-wing
mm-hmm.
jet.
Mm-hmm.
It was state-of-the-art at that point in time.
Okay. Where were you stationed?
Well, I returned to Dover Air Force Base,
mm-hmm.
and then we reported into Dover, and then... My family and I went out to Oklahoma City again. That's where we transitioned into the new airplane.
Okay.
3 months in Oklahoma City,
mm-hmm.
and then back to Dover.
Okay. So you did your flight training there in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me about the C-141.
Great airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It cruised at Mach 0.74.
Mm-hmm.
It was the airplane that replaced what they had then was like 707s and C-135.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using them as about the only jet that they really were operating.
Mm-hmm.
And the 141 came along just in time to replace that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in one of the first classes in the airplane. I guess the airplane came in the inventory maybe a couple months before I went through the training.
Okay.
So it was brand new to me and brand new to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys had never flown jets before because some of these guys came out of pilot training when they didn't have jets.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a transition for some of these guys never were able to upgrade in the 141. It was much faster, more powerful,
mm-hmm.
and it was a nice airplane to fly, though, very stable. And I guess I got about, 8,000 or 10,000 hours in the airplane.
Wow.
So I flew it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Where did you fly it during this time period?
Worldwide.
Okay, so you...
We went both to Europe as well as to Southeast Asia.
Okay. And how long was this tour? You're based out of Dover?
I was in Dover for a year and a half, yeah.
Okay.
And I volunteered to go to Vietnam because I really wanted to go back to graduate school. And that was the way I saw it. That was a ticket to, if you went through a combat tour, and I was planning to stay in the Air Force, you needed a combat tour in your record, and, and going back to graduate school, obviously, was a big plus, too.
Okay.
And there were some professional schools like Command and Staff or Air War College that, that basically I had flown so much. I had had about 5 years of consecutive flight time duty, and I was going all the time, too. I have to admit that, you know, from a domestic viewpoint, it was hard on my wife. I mean, she was raising two kids and all by herself, effectively.
Right.
I was gone all, I was gone probably 80, 90% of the time.
Wow. Wow.
So anyhow, I flew at Dover, and I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and I put down two airplanes. One was a B-57, and one was a C-123.
And you got the 123?
Yeah, that came through almost right away.
Okay. Did you know what you would be doing?
No, not exactly. I was later, I learned that I'd be flying ranch hand.
Okay. Okay. How did your wife feel about your volunteering to go to Vietnam?
Well, she didn't like it, but she understood why I was doing it.
Because
it wasn't much of a life the way it was.
Right, right. Okay, so you saw it maybe as a means to kind of further your career.
Yeah, sure.
Get into grad school.
And plus, you know, if you got a war going on and you're in the military, that's where you want to be.
Okay, so when did you arrive back in Vietnam? This is 1967?
Let's see, July 1967.
Okay.
We went from Dover down to Florida, down
okay.
here, and I transitioned into the C-123 at near Eglin Air Force Base and Hurlburt Field.
Okay.
And we flew there for about 3 months because it included formation, low-level training, and spray training.
Mm-hmm. Now, how difficult was it transitioning from the 141 to the 123?
Wasn't that tough. I mean, I was used to flying formation in the 141, and we flew low-level formation in that also for drop missions.
Okay.
But the 123 was a totally different ballgame. I mean, it was pretty basic. It just had two R2800 engines in it when I initially checked out on it. And I didn't know I was going to be, you know, flying spray until I got down here to the training, and then they told us that we'd be going to the ranch hand outfit.
What did you know about ranch hand up to that point?
Nothing, but it was scary. I mean, everybody that talked about it says, man, they get a lot of hits. You're going to be flying low level. You'll take a lot of ground fire. Some guys get shot down. It was a little different than what they call a trash haul in 123.
Right, right.
And anyhow, I had good instructors again. I was fortunate. And I didn't have any trouble transitioning into the airplane.
Okay. What kind of training did they put you through? Just practicing that low level?
Well, you start out just doing your basic landings and short field landings and short field takeoff. And then they, after you're capable of flying the airplane at, in all type of attitudes and flying an instrument approach and that type of thing, then they would transition you into the formation.
Okay.
And that was low-level formation. That was a different type of formation than I had flown. I mean, we were like 100 feet off the trees. That's what we sprayed at. And they had their own set of tactics, although I don't think the instructors we had in the formation part were previous ranch hand pilots.
Okay.
So they knew what it was all about, but they didn't have any spray tanks or anything like that on the airplane. Not here.
Okay. And they would teach you this once you got in country?
Yes.
Okay. Where were you based in Vietnam?
Benoit.
At Benoit. Tell me about flying back into Vietnam at Benoit, knowing you're going to be there a year. How did you feel about that? This is different from flying in and out of country, obviously.
Sure. It wasn't fun when I left my family in Florida. I mean, I can still remember it was a pretty sad moment for me. En route, I didn't go directly over to Vietnam. I went to the Philippines and had to go through jungle survival school.
Right.
And that was pretty interesting, to say the least. But there you met a lot of guys that were going to F-105s or F-4s or 123s or C-130s or all kinds of people. And then we went into Vietnam, and I remember the first night there was kind of scary because you could hear some of the gunfire and stuff. And we stayed in this real dingy hotel in Saigon. There were about six of us in a room, I think. And then the next day, we got airlifted into Benoit, and I had to report into the squadron there. It was called the 12th Air Commando Squadron, ACS.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even call it a troop carrier squadron. It was Air Commando.
Okay. What kind of quarters did you have at Benoit?
They were called hooches.
Mm-hmm.
Open bay with screens.
Okay.
And there were probably 6 to 8 guys per hooch.
Okay.
And it wasn't air conditioned, obviously, but
it
we
was
had
not,
a problem with. Pardon me.
It was not air conditioned.
No, no.
Okay.
We had a problem with security there. Vietnamese would come in and try to steal from me at night, so they had a metal locker that you had to lock everything into.
Mm-hmm.
And every night you would put your stuff in there and put a lock on it,
because
they would come and take something right off you, you know, right next to where you were sleeping.
So they come in at night while you were sleeping.
Yeah.
And try to take things.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Were these the civilians that were doing your laundry and cleaning up, or were these just people who would come in?
I think they were outsiders. We had a maid, and she was very good. I don't think she had anything to do with it. But I had a couple incidents there. I caught a guy stealing one night, and I pretty much knocked him out and sat on him until the air police came out and picked him up.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, every time you hear a loud noise at night, you were heading for the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought it was at first. Somebody was screaming, and they were yelling thief, and I thought, what is he saying? And I finally figured out he's yelling thief, and then I saw a guy running for the fence, and I went after him, and I caught him and subdued him and took him out into the street and called the air police, and they came over and picked him up. And he had my radio. The only thing he had on him was my radio.
Your radio.
Strangely enough, yes. And then in the Tet Offensive, we got overrun at the base, and we got rocketed regularly at Benoit. I'd say 3 times a week, almost, you would get rocketed.
Did that start when you got over there in July?
No, the Tet Offensive, I think...
Well, that was early, but this, the rocketing, did that kind of happen constantly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we also flew out of Da Nang.
Okay.
And we would go TDY to Da Nang for a couple of weeks and fly the mountain targets up there at Da Nang.
Okay.
And the first night I spent in Da Nang, we had a rocket attack, and I think they killed 7 guys in the building next to us. And I was just, you know, I was just barely in country, and I thought, oh man, it's going to be a long, long year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I remember them carrying these guys out in the sheets and stuff. But rockets are pretty nasty stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is that your first contact with the enemy through the rockets, or was it when you were actually flying?
I guess you'd say when you're flying, you're getting a ground fire.
Right.
You don't know exactly who's doing it, but we had fighter cover.
Mm-hmm.
We had like 4 airplanes, either A-1s or A-37s or F-4s or F-100s.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of those, I guess it's just the 4 type airplanes. And if we took ground fire, the guy in the back would throw a smoke grenade, and they would come in and suppress it.
Okay.
But we would stay on target. I mean, we'd stay on target until we finished it.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of sitting ducks. We're only doing 150 miles an hour at 100 feet above the trees.
Right.
So we were a fairly easy target.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we took a lot of hits. Most of them were not terribly significant. You'd get a rudder cable shot out or an elevator cable or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't get too much up in the cockpit. We had a couple guys shot right through the neck. In the cockpit, which was a very unusual case.
Has anybody ever hit in your airplane?
With me flying, no. But the guy who checked me out in country, he got shot down. He was killed.
Mm.
And then a couple guys I went through class with were shot down. They lost an engine, and then they went in upside down.
Mm.
And we lost a couple guys during the rocket attacks also.
Tell me about the rocket attacks. What would happen at night, or how do they prepare you? Did you have a drill that you would go through? Is it here? You know, if this happens, here's what you need to do.
Yeah, they pretty much brief you on that. And what you do, you sleep in the hooches, which are just cots.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the siren goes off, or if you hear a rocket come in down, everybody screams and jumps up and runs for the bunker.
Okay.
And those are sand-filled bags over PSP. With a roof on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the safest place you can be. You want to sit low or lay low inside of the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd stay there until the all-clear signal was given.
Okay. How many times do you think your base was rocketed?
While I was there?
Yes, sir.
50, 60.
Really?
At least. I mean, it was a regular thing for us. Mm-hmm. Most people, you know, if you had a senior officer or somebody come in for a visit or an inspection, mm-hmm. believe it or not, they did that, they would be sure to leave at night.
Oh, really?
They seldom ever spent the night at Benoit.
How did you guys feel about that?
Well, we thought they were a bunch of pansies, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were... Matter of fact, I remember one incident where a full colonel came in. He was newly assigned, and he was going to take over the maintenance operation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a rocket attack while we were going out to the airplanes that morning. Early in the morning, mm-hmm. they hit us. And the best thing you can do is just get down, lay flat on the concrete.
Mm-hmm.
He took some serious shrapnel in his back and his arm,
mm-hmm.
and he was bleeding to death, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And they drug him over to some kind of a vehicle and took him to the hospital. They saved his life, but I think he lost use of his arm for quite a period of time.
Mm.
And that was his first or second night on, you know, at Benoit. Poor
wow.
guy probably thought, I'll never make it. You know?
Right, right.
But you do get steeled to it. I mean, just like you watch these guys on television today,
mm-hmm.
you know, the journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time that they hear that siren and the first time they hear an explosion, they look scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the war, you're going to see them just sitting there with their mask and a flak vest and,
mm-hmm.
and a helmet, and they'll just be talking right through it.
Mm-hmm. Is that what happened to you?
Well, you have to. Otherwise, you go nuts. Now, there were some guys that really didn't handle it very well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember guys drinking in the bunkers or carrying a weapon into the bunker and
mm-hmm.
And drinking, and you're saying, my God, you know, I'm going to have this.
Right.
It's one or the other, but I don't want you drinking anyhow.
Right.
You're of no use to anybody.
Right, right. So that one night of seven killed, were those the only KIAs that happened because of rocket attacks while you were there?
No, that was just the one night.
Okay.
No, I ended up losing everything I owned. Our hooch burned right to the ground.
Really?
And I went back about a week after when the thing cooled off, and I was able to find my ring,
mm-hmm.
which I had locked in my locker.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my academy ring. Mm-hmm. And I could tell where my bed had been because I had a fan, and that was melted down to a lump.
Mm-hmm.
And my watch was melted down to a lump.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to find my ring under about 6 inches of ashes, believe it or not.
Wow.
Because I knew where it had been.
Mm-hmm.
And... I still have the ring. I was able to get it cleaned up, and it was white gold, so it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else, I had a bicycle. I had all kinds of letters. I had a painting a guy did of me, of a 141, I mean, a 123, and
mm-hmm.
it was something I really liked, but it all got burned up. I lost it. I had nothing fancy there. I mean, everything I had was basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys had big stereo units and stuff like that, and
mm-hmm.
I never needed anything like that. But anyhow, I lost everything I had, and I flew again the next morning.
Wow.
I think I had shower clogs and a flying suit, you know.
So was this when you were gone, you said? It hit? You had a direct hit on your hooch?
No. It wasn't a direct hit on the hooch. It was a direct hit on a... Actually, we had a couple that were very close to the bunker.
Okay.
And one of the bunkers was hit, and that's where about six or seven guys were killed.
Okay.
That night, that Tet Offensive.
Okay, that was the Tet Offensive night.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and describe what happened that night?
I don't remember what time it was. It was probably about 2 o'clock in the morning, and boy, the rockets started coming in. The siren went off. We all hit the bunker as usual. We didn't know there was anything different.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was intense. I mean, it was a lot more intense than what we're used to. Usually, you'd catch a couple of rockets coming in, and when it was over, you'd go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But this night, it continued. And then it caught fire. The hooch caught fire. The bunker caught fire because the sandbags caught fire.
Mm-hmm.
All the sand started pouring out, so there was no protection at all. We ended up in a ditch. And I remember I had my M16 and laying in the ditch in my flying suit, and we were there all night.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, daylight came, and I guess they captured a number of people that were trying to overrun the base.
Mm-hmm.
And we were... I don't know that we had anybody in my unit killed. I don't think so. I think most of us were okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we went right back to work that morning. So then we slowly acquired some boots and another flying suit. But I truly lost everything I had. I didn't have anything left.
Hmm. Did you write home about this or tell your wife about this?
I guess I did eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that... I don't think I wrote her about that particularly. I just said, you know, that we had a rocket attack or something like that. But she saw it on the news. She knew that the Tet Offensive included Benoit.
Right, right. How did you fly that next morning? I mean, what kind of mindset did you have?
I was shaken, I guess, but once you're flying it, it was really almost therapeutic to get back in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather have been in the airplane than have some staff job, because flying, I flew almost every day, and flying normally twice a day. I mean, you were preoccupied, you were focused on what you were doing, and then you would target study that afternoon for the next one. So you were flying almost every day. We did have an R&R finally. I guess there was a couple months left of my tour, and I met my wife in Hawaii, and that's when I think I told her about that.
Okay. Was that the only R&R you took while on your tour? Okay. How long were you there in Hawaii?
A week.
Okay. What did that do for you mentally?
It was tough. It was great to see her, and we were unable to get a hotel. I had a hotel reservation, and that for some reason they canceled it. And we ended up going out to a place called Fort Bellows, which was an Army camp. But it was a bunch of little houses on the beach, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was much better than a hotel room.
Right.
I think it was $8 a night.
Wow.
And she and I had our own place, and then we were driving to Honolulu at night. But during the day, we could just, you know, eat our meals out there, and we could lay on the beach, and we just had a really nice time. And then I had a couple months to go on my tour when I got back.
Okay.
A correction. I did have another R&R. They could call it an R&R, where we ferried a C-123 up to Taipei near Taiwan. And we had to stay there, I think, a couple days. While they, it was called Iran for the airplane, inspect and repair as necessary. And they went completely through the airplane, and I think another airplane was finished, and then we flew that back to Vietnam.
Okay.
So that was considered an R&R, if you would.
Were you ever wounded at all offline? Or
no.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question about those rocket attacks. How did you deal with death? The idea of death, the idea that you could be shot down any time, the idea that a rocket could hit your hooch at any time?
I remember initially, you know, the first month or two, I was really focused on it. I was trying to think, God, what if something happened to me, you know? And I also realized how unpredictable it was. One day you were doing fine. I mean, I made a life over there. I mean, I played handball every afternoon. We had a handball court. I would play intense games of handball for an hour or two in that kind of heat.
Right.
And by the time you showered and cleaned up, you felt like $1 million, and you're ready to go hit it again the next day. So I stayed in really good physical shape when I was there. I did. I drank. You know, everybody drank. But that was just part of the game. And I think I had a very strong support at home. My wife's tough. She's very tough, durable, and she put up with a lot of nonsense. I'll tell you one little aside if you have a second.
Oh, absolutely. We have all the time you need.
When my wife decided to stay in Fort Walton Beach, we thought it was the best thing because she didn't really want to go back to Pennsylvania where my home was because there weren't anybody. There were no people from that area who had husbands in Vietnam. Down in Fort Walton Beach, there were a lot of military families and families that were waiting for their husbands. And besides, it was a pretty place, and we had two little boys, and we got her a little apartment up on the beach where there was a pool, so it was good. I did not know until I had been in country for 2 or 3 months that she wasn't getting paid. She was supposed to have received an allotment, which I set up, and I was living, I think I was living on $100 a month, and all the rest of my pay, everything was going to my wife. Well, I got a letter of apology from the base commander at, I think he was a base commander at Eglin, and he apologized to me. He was a full colonel, and he apologized on behalf of the Air Force for the terrible treatment that my wife had received.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I knew that she had had a problem.
Hmm.
She didn't want to burden me with that, and she just worked her way through it herself. But
mm-hmm.
she got the normal bureaucratic runaround from the Air Force. Not intentionally. It's just they lost the paperwork or they screwed something up.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no money. She had to borrow money from some friends until she finally got it reinstated.
Mm.
And when I found that out, I just felt like getting on an airplane and coming back. I was furious.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a turning point for me, frankly, as far as my career.
Really?
Yeah. I just didn't want my family to have to experience crap like that.
Mm-hmm. What kind of turning point was it for you?
Well, I just didn't feel that they supported my family. I mean, they sent me off to war. And they didn't even take care of the basic things for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she had tried through numerous people and numerous offices to get the thing corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no luck doing that. And she's no shy violet.
Right.
I mean, she finally had to threaten this girl. She was going to call her senator and go public with this thing. That what a horrific situation she was in.
Mm-hmm.
She had a family. She had two little boys to take care of, mm-hmm. and she didn't have enough money to buy food.
Mm.
But we got it corrected, and after that, things settled down. And it was okay after that. But that was kind of a turning point for me because I put my paperwork in a couple months before I came back. And I decided to get out. And when I came back, they reassigned me to C-141s at McGuire Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew them for a year, and then I transitioned. I went off active duty one day, and the next day I went into the reserve unit.
Okay.
We had what was called an associate reserve unit.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent opportunity for me to fly and still have a job.
Right.
And I thoroughly enjoyed that. I stayed in the reserves for 17 years mm-hmm. then after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot more fun flying than I ever did on active duty.
Did the Air Force try to convince you to stay active?
Yeah, they did. I mean, the squadron commander tried to talk to me, but I had pretty much made up my mind
mm-hmm.
at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There had been too many cases where she received lousy medical care, she received lousy support, and most of the time it was when I was gone, either on a trip or over in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't there to help. And like I said, she was not afraid to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
But she was, you know, she was not a needy person. She just wanted to be treated properly, that's
right.
all.
Right. Let's go back to Benoit. Tell me what base life was like. I'll ask you about your flying just in a little bit, but what was it like there on base? What did you guys do?
Well, like I said, we made the best of it.
Right.
They actually had a swimming pool there. And I was, like I said, I swam for most of my life. And I really enjoyed. We would play handball, then we'd shower down and then take a swim.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it refreshed me. And I stayed. Oh, I took two college courses.
Did you?
While I was there on base. As a matter of fact, we had a rocket attack during one of the finals. I'll never forget that.
Uh-huh.
And we run to the bunker, and we're sitting in the bunker there, you know, and everybody, you think you're scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy next to me, he says, "What'd you get for number 7? Only in Vietnam.
That's funny.
The food was pretty good. We
uh-huh.
could eat in the mess hall or the officers' club. I guess we drank a lot of beer. I didn't drink anything but beer, but
mm-hmm.
We would sing. Ranch Hand was a very high morale.
Right.
We were a very spirited group, to say the least. We used to wear purple scarves,
mm-hmm.
and I still have my purple scarves, and we still have reunions. I haven't been to one, but when I left Vietnam, I had collected some shrapnel and stuff I wanted to show my kids. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, before I got in the airplane, I took it and threw it in the trash. I said, I don't really want to take this crap back with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I hated it or anything. It's just that I didn't want to dwell on it.
Mm-hmm.
And after I came home, I had a couple incidents where I had some bad dreams and stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I never experienced anybody spitting on me or attacking me or
mm-hmm.
verbally or whether I probably would have lost it if anybody had ever tried something like that.
Right.
But I didn't, so I was fortunate.
Right.
I was also a little older than the average bear over there, and
mm-hmm.
I was more mature. I had a family, and I don't think I was subjected to that kind of stuff. As far as life on the base, Benoit wasn't a bad place, actually. We had a library.
Mm-hmm.
We had an officers club. What else did we have? Oh, we even had movies once in a while. You could see a movie if you wanted. I didn't care for that particularly. And then our hooch was our home. We had maybe six guys in our hooch, and then we had one little section of the hooch that we fixed up. We apprehended or were able to obtain some fly. We traded something for something. It was kind of like MASH. And we got some plywood, and we fixed up a little bar. We had a refrigerator. And so we were able to, you know, have some cold beer when we came back. And that was fun. I mean, we even had a little Christmas tree and, you know, and went through all that. I mean, it's the old thing, Richard, that you ask yourself, what am I doing here? You're really kind of working to protect your buddy. And you respect him, and he respects you, and you make a life out of it. And we did that. And another incident I'll relate to you. I thought we had it fairly tough there because we didn't have, quote, air-conditioned quarters, blah, blah, blah. One day I was in the bathroom, the latrine, they call it, and we had, believe it or not, we had a hot shower because we had a hot water heater, and we ran a pipe from the hot water heater across up into a big coffee can that had holes in the bottom. And the cold water and the hot water would mix in that coffee can, and you could actually take a warm shower. And there was a young Marine came up to me while I was in there, and he had all his battle gear on, and he was covered with mud from head to toe. And he said, "Excuse me, sir." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Could I take a shower?" He says, "I'm here on R&R." And I said, "You're in Benoit on an R&R?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "By all means." And that young guy took his mud-crusted clothes off and his rifle and all his battle gear. And he just stood under that shower, and his eyes rolled back in his head because it was the first time a kid had had a shower probably in months. And at the end, he dried himself. I gave him a towel, and he dried himself off. And I think he shaved, and then he put his stuff back on. He was so grateful. And I said, "You know, how tough do I have it? This is an R&R for this young fella. And I'm whining about, you know, not having air conditioning. Forget it." I think that kind of focused me and rearranged my perspective somewhat.
When did that happen? How far into your tour there?
Halfway, I think.
Okay.
By that time, I had adapted to the life. There was another guy we had who was a navigator, and his solution to dealing with stress was to exercise. He was doing like 900 sit-ups a day. The guy finally flipped, I think, because he was gone. He was there one day and gone the next. I think they put him in a psycho ward or something. But that was the only really kind of breakdown that I ever saw for the guys that I flew with. Some guys were scared more than others. I was too busy to be scared because I became like the chief pilot, and I was checking guys out in the country. And it was some of the best flying I've ever done as far as pure flying. I mean, we would shut engines down on the way back from target and then restart them to prove to the guy if they got an engine shot out, it would fly on one engine. And, you know, we'd do stuff like that, and it became routine. And today, you know, you wouldn't do that. It's like practicing for an accident, you know.
Tell me about what was your typical day like as far as your flying was concerned.
We would get up about 4, and we'd grab a bite to eat in the mess hall, and we'd brief. We'd jump in our little van, and we would brief down at the squadron about 5 o'clock or something like that. We would fly early because if it got too warm, the spray would not settle down into the trees. It would just drift off because of the heat rising. Then after the brief, I was either flying lead most of the time, or I was in the back of the pack, either 3-ship or 6-ship. And I usually had a student, so I would fly in the back so, you know, I could show them things and teach them things, and I would call up the lead and tell them that we're going to slide out to the port side and shut an engine down. And one time we shut one down and couldn't get the damn thing started again. And I said, "This is not supposed to happen." So we had to call for an escort, and we got an F-100 to come out and escort us back to the base, because if we had gone down out there, they would have never found us. And we used to fly the DMZ sometimes with big 6 12-ship formations, mm-hmm. and that was pretty exciting. I mean, that was unusual, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
Then, anyhow, we would fly the first sortie. We would usually hit a target that was fairly close, so that we would only be up for an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
We'd come back, refuel, reherb, and back in the airplane. And then we'd fly formation, loose formation of the next target, join up, and then we'd go back on a second target.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be done by noon, probably, or earlier.
Okay.
We didn't always fly two sorties. If the weather was really bad, we might cancel one. But we flew through all kinds of weather. I remember I rode up. I thought it was a little scary the way these guys were flying, and they'd hit weather, and we had no procedures.
Mm-hmm.
How to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote up some weather procedures, which I think we incorporated, and I felt a lot better after that because we knew how to break formation and then rejoin afterwards. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you had a three-ship, you'd go into a, instead of an echelon, you would go into an in-trail formation, and then one guy would break left, the other guy would break right, and stay on that heading for a minute or so and then turn back the original heading. So you'd have separation
mm-hmm.
through the weather. You just maintained the heading, but you were separated by half a mile or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you got out of the weather, or if you never did get out of the weather, you would recover individually.
Okay.
Whereas if you got out of the weather, you would join up again.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the neat things is when we used to come back to land, we always came back in and went into a right or left echelon, and we pitched out just like the fighters. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Instead of flying in a rectangular pattern, we mm-hmm. would come over on initial, and we would break. Just like the fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just come straight around and touch down 1, 2, 3, or 4, 5, 6.
Mm-hmm.
And when we used to go to Da Nang for the TDY, we had a guy, each of the airplanes had a chute in it, you know, like the fighters used
mm-hmm.
to pop a drag chute.
Mm-hmm.
We would come in and the guy would deploy the chute and it was attached to the back.
Was that necessary?
No. And I still remember the guy at the Nang Tower the first time we did that. We're taxing him with the chutes, you know, and he
mm-hmm.
says, shit hot ranch hand. It was. We made a game out of it whenever
mm-hmm.
we could.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the typical day was, two sorties, and then we'd grab a bite to eat and maybe go over and play some handball.
Mm-hmm.
And my roommate and I played handball, and sometimes we'd have cutthroat and the third guy. And
mm-hmm.
and then after that, we would maybe go over and take a swim, and then we'd have a cocktail before dinner and go over and eat and go to bed early.
Okay.
That was the deal.
Okay. Tell me about your briefings. What kind of intelligence would you receive, and how would you rate that intelligence?
As far as I know, it was pretty good. We had an intelligence officer in the squadron, and we
mm-hmm.
always made fun of, you know. We always told him we knew more about what was going on than he did.
Mm-hmm. Was that true?
Probably.
Uh-huh.
But he was very conscientious, and we would have a debrief after the missions, too. So
mm-hmm.
he was updated, theoretically, after every mission.
Okay.
What we saw, what kind of ground fire we saw,
mm-hmm.
Did we notice anything unusual? And sometimes we took some really heavy ground fire,
mm-hmm.
and when you saw that, you know, that they wouldn't have put us on that target had they known differently.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the enemy knew at times that you were coming that way?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Unfortunately, our targets were pretty much approved by the Vietnamese, and so it became fairly political.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing what we were told, but, you know, there was so much corruption going on over there. Who knows why we were hitting a particular target.
Right. Tell me about the herbicide you were spraying. How much contact did you have with it physically?
We used to fly with our windows on. We had sliding side windows,
mm-hmm.
and we had armored plate under the seats and around the, below the windows. It was thick. It was about an inch, inch and a quarter armor
mm-hmm.
plate.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew with the windows open because we didn't want to shatter the plexiglass when the bullets came through. Because,
mm-hmm.
Like I said, we'd stay on target, and they'd just sit there and shoot at us as we came back.
Mm-hmm.
But we got a little smarter later on, too. We didn't, you know, have a death wish or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was the question you asked again?
Just how much contact you had with the Agent Orange, with the herbicide you were spraying.
The stuff would come in the windows.
Okay.
And you'd come back and you'd have the stuff on you.
Okay.
I mean, there's no question that we didn't exactly take a bath in it, but we sure got lots of it. If you were lead, you were fine, but if you were back in the pack, you definitely got herbicide on the airplane and in the cockpit.
What did they tell you about it?
They didn't tell us there was any problem with it.
Okay.
I was never told that it was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
The generic name for it was Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had stuff called purple,
mm-hmm.
and what the hell else was it? It was white, purple, and another color. There were different types depending
mm-hmm.
on what your target was.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we used to get the bullets winging through the cockpit sometimes, and that's when a guy, especially if he was in a turn, we were pretty well protected if they were shooting at us from below.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were in a turn at the end of the... We would are you familiar at all with right and left echelon?
Yes, sir.
Airplanes. We would come on and make a high rate descent on the target, and then we'd go into, say, we're doing a rectangular target. We would go into, a left echelon.
Why don't you explain that for those who will be listening to this in the future?
When we proceeded to and from target, we would fly either a loose formation or in trail
mm-hmm.
where we were stacked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more it's easier to maneuver when you're in trail. When
mm-hmm.
you're in an echelon, you have to be a little more, you have to be less aggressive in your
mm-hmm.
in your maneuvers. But normally we flew like a loose formation to and from the target, and frequently if we had new pilots, we would let them fly fairly tight formations just for the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would come on the target. The lead airplane would have a navigator, and we would usually almost always have a FAC, and he would smoke the target for us.
Okay.
And that was usually the spray on point.
Mm-hmm.
So we would stay in formation and then go into a high rate descent, pull all the power off and come down as quickly as we could. And then we would level off at 100 feet, push the power back up and call for, say, a left echelon.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could have echelon before we went down.
Mm-hmm.
It depended on what the target was flying. It was up to Lee to do what to make the call.
Okay.
And then we were on a left echelon, and we would spray on, and we would go stay spray on until we got to the end of the target.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we were going to make repeated passes, we would go spray off, and then the lead would pull up, and we would automatically slide into trail. Two would go in and three behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would do a 90-270 turn. And we were very maneuverable. That airplane was a tough old battle airplane.
I was going to say, what was that 123? How was it handling?
It was great. I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
You could really bank and yank it. And anyhow, lead would do a 90-degree turn, say, to the left,
mm-hmm.
and then he'd come back around and do a 270-degree turn to the right, so you're heading back to the target.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would go into another echelon, depending. If you came off on a left echelon, he would probably come back and give you another left echelon coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So he would be flying a strip of land where adjacent to the one that number three man had just sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way you would cover the target. And you would continue to do that until you had completed your target.
Okay. How many times would you have to come back and spray the same target?
I don't remember how long. I think we had 1,000 gallons of herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how long the target was, determined how many, how long you could spray.
Okay.
So, you might make, I'd say, 4 to 6 turns at the end of the target to, reverse course,
mm-hmm.
come back, spray on, spray off, reverse course, spray on, spray off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you finished up, and then you went max power and climbed off the target.
Okay.
Depending whether you're getting ground fire or not. But you had, like I said, you had a FAC smoking the target, and he usually knew if there was any ground fire.
Mm-hmm.
Not always. Sometimes he would be amazed that we were getting ground fire when he didn't think there was any.
Mm-hmm.
And
so when you're getting ground fire, say on your first pass, you just would simply turn and continue and come right back into it?
Oh, yeah. You didn't just, pack it in.
Mm-hmm.
You just stayed on target. But we did have fighters.
Right. You call it suppressive fire?
Yeah, and they would lay down some CBUs. Cluster bomb units,
mm-hmm.
put the heads down, and we'd still get fire, but it was much more suppressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How effective was the herbicide itself?
Very effective.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we had a guy named Snuffy Smith.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the guys that was been there 6 months when I got there. You're always an FNG, a new guy. mm-hmm. or you're an old-timer just counting the days.
Mm-hmm.
And Snuffy took off and lost an engine with 1,000 gallons of herbicide on. Now, understand, we took off well overweight of the airplane. You never took off that heavy with a cargo mm-hmm. with trash on it.
Mm-hmm.
But we, because we had, quote, ability to jettison the herbicide, we could take off a lot heavier.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, Snuffy took off, I guess he was number two or three or something, and he lost an engine. And he was so heavy, he couldn't maintain altitude. Tried mm-hmm. to jettison, the damn thing wouldn't jettison.
Mm.
So he didn't have much choice. So you know what he did? He went spray on. And he sprayed all the way around a rectangular pattern to come back in and make an emergency landing.
Huh.
And every day when you took off, you could see this brown path all the way up. A perfect rectangular pattern. And he was able to maintain the airplane. I mean, it was pretty good thinking.
Uh-huh.
He killed a few trees that people didn't want to kill, but
right.
Snuffy made it.
Have you had any medical effects at all from your exposure?
My wife thinks I have, but I don't. No, I'm okay. I've been going back for that annual, triannual physical.
Mm-hmm.
I guess every 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, I'm 65 years old now, and I'm mm-hmm. I'm still doing okay.
Okay, okay. What were your impressions of the enemy?
Well, I didn't see them face to face, you know. I thought they were very determined people.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the wrong place at the wrong time, I think, and we didn't have the ability to go after them.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy was determined, and they could live out in the jungle for months, and we couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was so politicized, I'm not sure that our intelligence or our security was that good.
Mm-hmm.
But the enemy, you have to respect them.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they were fighting for what was right, and they were tough.
Mm-hmm. What would you say were his strengths and weaknesses?
Well, his strengths was his determination and ability to survive off the land.
Mm-hmm.
He was used to the environment, and we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
His weaknesses were, I think, like these rocket attacks. They would come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, each guy with a piece of the rocket,
mm-hmm.
and they get down in South Vietnam, and they would meet and assemble this rocket and shoot a rocket off, and then they'd truck it on back. I mean, weakness being, you had to wonder about the futility of it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, that goes back to their determination. They were getting bombed and strafed and
mm-hmm.
and firebombed, and they just hung in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what their weaknesses might have been, other than the fact that they were probably ill-equipped and they were brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we were a little brainwashed, too. I don't know.
Did you ever do any spray missions in Cambodia or Laos?
Yeah, I think we did in Laos.
Okay.
But I don't remember much about it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, no, it sounds like it was just another routine mission. You just went to a different geographical area.
Yeah, it was usually, I know we did, and I think we had A-1s covering for us, because they were the best cover airplane for us.
Why?
They had so much firepower, and mm-hmm. they could stay on target with us.
Okay.
An F-4 would come down and make one pass, and they'd have to go back up, turn around, and come back.
Mm-hmm.
F-100s were good, too. And so were the A-37s, but the A-1s were the best.
Okay.
And they were, Sandy, normally, was their call sign.
Mm-hmm.
And they were normally they seemed to be very experienced pilots.
Mm-hmm. Could you request your cover, or did it just, is whatever was there that day?
Yeah, but we were scheduled for the cover. We used to fly with some of these guys in the cockpit with us, the fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm.
They would come and sit on a armor-plated box on the center console.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed a pretty good respect for us. Here we are down 100 feet getting shot at.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were glad to have them because it gave them an appreciation of what we were doing down
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever fly with them?
No.
Okay.
I don't think we were ever invited to. But,
okay.
I mean, they pretty much had a single-seat airplane if they had a trainer. If they had a TF model, they normally had someone in there as a student. I don't know that they had that luxury.
How did you guys get along as pilots?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah, we never had any problems.
Okay. What kind of weapons did you carry?
38. mm-hmm. and M16.
You had that in the plane with you?
We had it on our person. Yeah, we had a 38 okay. strapped to us. We had a survival vest on with a bunch of stuff on it, mm-hmm. a flak vest over that. I guess we had a flak vest and then the survival vest over that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know I had an M16. We would keep it right next to us in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And a 38. Some guys might have carried something differently, but that's all I ever had.
Okay. Did you guys ever return fire at all?
Yeah, some Lulu would stick the gun out of the back of the airplane mm-hmm. and strafe with it, but that was kind of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Made them feel good, but I don't think it did anything.
Right. Did you have all the weapons that you wanted personally, or was there something that you did not have that you did want?
No, I felt like that's about all I could handle.
Okay.
Trying to fly the airplane.
Okay. Tell me about the Agent Orange tank back there, the herbicide tank. This was, I've heard stories that the stuff was all over the airplane, kind of sloshing around. It was quite messy. What was it like?
No, the tanks were well maintained. There was a pump and there was a armor-plated box that the guy, the flight engineer, after we were coming on target, he would get out. He would leave the cockpit and go back and climb down into his armor-plated box.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the troop doors removed.
Mm-hmm.
So he could throw smoke grenades out if we took fire.
Okay.
And he would sit down low in the box, and when we said spray on, he would have the pump pressure, the pump on and the pressure up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would actually spray from the cockpit. We had a little switch on the yoke.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just kind of keep his head down there and keep the pressure up on the tank. But as far as I know, it was a pretty good system.
Okay. Okay. Your particular aircraft, did you take any, you took hits, but was there anything that you remember, any specific incident where you had some serious problems from the hits you took?
It wasn't unusual to lose a cable or something, but there was normally another cable you could use, or you had some kind of a problem. If you lost an engine,
mm-hmm.
if you lost a flight control and an engine, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just lost one or the other, you could still deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were numerous times that, we either had an engine problem or lost an engine
mm-hmm.
and had to come back single engine. I mean, that wasn't real unusual.
Okay.
I remember the first time I got a bullet through the airplane, scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But it was one of those up in Da Nang, I remember, and it tore a huge hole in the back of the airplane.
Hmm.
And it was probably 50 millimeter. I don't know what it was, but. 50 cal, but it got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was ground fire. We used to tell a story about a guy that got a spear at the bottom of the airplane. I don't know if that was true or not, but
uh-huh.
I do know that we used to take bullets, ground fire from above us.
Really?
Yeah, because we'd be flying through a valley,
mm-hmm.
and they'd be up on the ridge line uh-huh. and shooting at us, and we'd actually be lower than the ridge line. And the bullets would come in the top and go out the bottom of the airplane.
Mm. Jeez, so, did they get better with their shooting as you were there?
Not that I noticed.
Okay.
I took about 35 hits or so, I think, total in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
None on me.
Okay. Did you ever work with any of the indigenous forces, the South Vietnamese?
I think that, some of the things were coordinated, but... I didn't really get involved in that very much.
Okay.
If they were, it wasn't my my area of responsibility.
So you had pretty limited contact with them?
Yeah.
What was their reputation? What did you hear about them?
Wasn't great.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were very good, I think. And others were, I don't think they really were that well trained or had their heart in it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you have to stop and think, what would you be like if you were being... your whole country is at war,
mm-hmm.
We had people everywhere you couldn't trust. I don't know. I don't know how I would react, but I think their pilots were fairly good,
mm-hmm.
but it depends on what kind of mission they were flying to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how gutsy they were, frankly.
Okay. Did you ever work with any of the other allied forces, the Australians, the South Koreans, New Zealanders, any of those?
Yeah, they might have been in the area where we were mm-hmm. spraying or working, so we would, be careful not to try to put any spray on those
mm-hmm.
guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they would obviously have to know that we would be coming in, because any airplane flying over could be a threat to, you know, if you didn't know who it was.
Right, right.
But we did, obviously, we had air superiority, so we pretty much flew where we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And the targets would vary a lot. So you had one target, you'd go down the Delta, that was considered a piece of cake.
Mm-hmm.
And another target, you would go up north. But frankly, I think we got hit on targets a lot of times when we expected it to be a piece of cake.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we expected a real hot target, and we didn't take any ground fire.
Mm.
I don't know. So that may tell you that intelligence wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm. Where was the one place in South Vietnam that you really dreaded flying, that you did not want to go over and spray?
It wasn't the Delta. The Delta was pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
It were the targets probably around anything around Saigon or Benoit.
Really?
Or north of it, you know. Some of the mountain targets we took some ground fire to, mm-hmm, up near Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember specifically any dreaded spot, you know.
Okay. As far as life on base, how much contact did you have home with your wife and everything? Did you write her?
We had a great deal. We wrote regularly. I, mm-hmm, probably wrote 4 to 5 letters a week.
Mm-hmm.
She would write to me. We also sent tapes back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And a neat thing we did, our boys were 2 and 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And let me think a minute. It's not true. Kevin was 5 and Mark was 3. I guess 3 and 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy, my wife, would send me a book, and I would read the book on the tape. And
huh.
What?
That's, yeah, okay.
And then I would send the tape back to the boys and send the book back.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could open the book and hear me read the book.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. That was a great idea.
Yeah.
That was her idea.
Uh-huh. Do your boys remember that?
Yeah, but you know what? The other day, not the other day, a month or so ago, we were cleaning out some stuff in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did we come across some, we came across some letters from her,
mm-hmm,
and from me, but we also came across some old tapes. And the kids are on there, you know, when they're 2 and,
mm-hmm,
I mean, 3 or 5 years old. And we let them hear these tapes and what they sounded like,
mm-hmm,
when they were this age.
Hmm.
And it was pretty neat. And listening to the tapes again at this time is, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Right. Did you ever make any of the Mars phone calls?
I don't think so.
Okay. How well were you able to keep up with the news back in the United States?
Well, we read the Stars and Stripes.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that we had any other sources of information at that point, unless somebody, you know, during the intelligence briefing told us something.
Right. Okay. Do you think the war affected your religious beliefs at all?
No.
Okay. Did you notice its effect on any of the other men?
Some of the younger guys, I thought, were, I think, more stricken by the stress of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And other guys were just tough as nails.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had guys there that could help you if you were really shaken about something.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm,
I never had that problem. The first month or two, I was scared most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, you know, you settle into a life, and
mm-hmm,
you could be on the moon if, you know, if that's where you were, and
mm-hmm,
you live it, that's all.
Right.
I sure didn't count days for a long time. I mean, if you started counting how many days you had left day one you were there, you probably had a long tour.
Mm-hmm. What about the relationship with the guys in your unit? Did you form some special relationships with them?
Yeah, I guess one of my best friends was my roommate, a guy named, mm-hmm, Bill Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
And someday I'm going to go look him up again. But we had a lot of laughs together. We used to hang out together a lot. We,
mm-hmm,
played handball together. We'd go to the club together. And there were probably 10 other guys in the unit. Tom Quinn I went through training with.
Mm-hmm.
He and I were good friends. And probably 10 other guys that I was good friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew everybody in the squadron. And if we flew together, either as a pilot or if he was a navigator and you were lead, you got to know him real well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a very tight group.
Mm-hmm. Do you keep in touch with any of them?
Not directly, no. Funny you should ask that. I often ask myself why I didn't, but I guess if I went to one of the reunions, which I plan to go to the next one,
mm-hmm,
they're usually down here in Florida, and we always had something going on. But I know that I'd see some. I mean, I remember a lot of their names. I have a lot of 8mm movie film of Ranch Hand.
Okay.
I don't know if that would ever be of interest to you, but you could see close up what we were doing. I would be flying the airplane, and I would say, okay, take the airplane for just 30 seconds or so, and I'd shoot like a descent, a rapid descent on the target, or I would let the other guy, because we were both considered aircraft commanders. We didn't have any co-pilots. And if he was flying the airplane for a minute or so, I could shoot a film.
Right.
But I got some really good pictures of it.
Okay.
I have to put them on videotape so I can let my kids have them. I'm sure they'd like to see them.
Right, right. Exactly.
I've never shown them to them.
Did you have any or encounter any racial issues while you were there?
Racial issues?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely not, no.
Okay.
Wasn't even a consideration.
Okay. Okay. What would you describe as one of the more humorous events that you remember from your tour?
Well, like I said, the guy, when we were taking a final exam and we ran in the bunker, he was more interested in whether he could answer question number 7 than whether he was going to live or not. That kind of grabbed me.
Okay.
We had some fun times at the club. We used to drink it up a little bit and then throw the glass, and we got in some trouble for doing that. It was stupid, but, you know, you act a little bit like children. But other humorous events, we had a lot of fun, like just getting together at after a mission or something. If we had a particularly tough mission, we'd go back over to the club and toast each other. We did a lot of toasting. And we had a few favorite songs, which a couple chants we used to use. That it kind of kept the edge off, you know.
Right. Did you all listen to music a lot while you were there?
Yeah. I didn't have a lot of music to listen to. I think I mainly listened to the tapes from home and read the letters. And like I said, taking the college courses over there was a diversion for me. It kept my head on straight. I mean, you didn't sit around and, you know, wring your hands all day long. You just went to work like everybody else.
Right. Which courses did you take?
An accounting course. Never had an accounting course. I was more of an engineering type. I took an accounting course, and I took a business management course.
Okay. How about USO shows? Did you ever get to any of those?
Oh, yeah. Best one was Australian. I still remember that one.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, they had a beautiful girl, and she put on a show at the club. And her only prop was an army cot, I think. But it was a great show.
An army cot?
Yeah.
Well, can you explain that?
I don't remember exactly what she did, but she was a dancer. And she just used a cot, you know.
Okay.
It wasn't loot or anything. She was just a great-looking gal, and she put on a really good show.
Okay.
We didn't get the Bob Hope deals, you know, like you see. I don't think we ever had one of them. But they were... they were like smaller groups of people, less well-known.
Okay. On base, did you guys have any encounters with wild animals, snakes, rats, anything like that?
Not that I remember.
Okay. Did your unit have any pets?
One of the guys, I think, had a dog, but I don't remember. That was the last thing I was thinking about over there.
Okay, yeah. What would you say was one of the more brave actions that you witnessed in Vietnam?
I guess it's hard to define that in the kind of flying we were doing. I think it took guts to get in the airplane and go do it. The incident I related to you about that young Marine that came in and just took a shower, I felt so sorry for that kid. I just wanted to, you know, invite him to come on and spend the night with us and relax a little bit, you know. I don't think we had it tough. I think those kids had it tough. And they were young, and they were probably not necessarily led by anyone particularly, you know, well-educated, well-trained. I don't know. I don't know that. I had a lot of admiration for those kids. I did. As far as a single act, I mean, when we were taking a lot of ground fire on target, and we had to keep going back and go, we could have left, but going back until we finished the job, that I thought took some courage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Do you know what ever became of that kid? Did he?
No.
After his shower, that was the last you saw of him?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just like one of those little glimpses in time, and you sort of wish he had gotten his name or something, but he was so grateful.
Mm-hmm. What about the leadership in Vietnam? How would you rate your leadership in your squadron?
Average. I think the guys that flew the most really were the leaders. The squadron commander and the ops officer. Squadron commander really didn't do much. The ops officer we had, I didn't have a lot of respect for.
Okay.
He was a hard ass, but he did fly. I mean, he wasn't sitting in the office. He did fly, but I don't know. He didn't show me a lot as far as being a kind of quality officer I would have looked up to. Guys my age and my rank, I had more respect for.
You were a captain, is that right?
I was a captain there, yeah.
Okay. How old were you?
let's see.
Almost 30, 29.
I was 29 when I went over and almost 30 when I came home.
Okay. What about the overall military leadership in the war? What do you think about that?
I thought there was a lot of lying with body counts and crap like that. I remember we had a general came on base one time and told us he wanted us to beautify the base and tear down the bunkers. And I thought it was a bad joke, and he was actually serious.
Tear down your bunker that you would go to during a rocket attack?
Yeah, he thought they were ugly.
Yeah.
And I still remember his name, but I won't recite that.
Did you tear down the bunker?
No.
Okay.
Told him to screw off. he didn't spend the night at Benoit.
Okay. So, besides the line about the body count, what else did you think they were dishonest about?
I think the way the war was going, I don't think it was going nearly as well as it was being reported.
Okay.
And the body counts played a role in that. I thought it was misleading. And I think it was too political for us to ever win. I didn't suffer on that too much when I was there, but afterwards, when I look back on everything, and it wasn't guys flying ranch hand that were going to win the war, but it was guys that could have defeated the enemy with their firepower that were not able to.
What do you think the United States could have done differently?
Differently?
Yes, sir.
We could have empowered the military to win the war, but we were being limited all the time. Even our targets were being politically determined. We weren't defeating the enemy where he was. We were reacting to the political climate in the country. My wife just mentioned we weren't allowed to fly over the French rubber plantations. I remember that. For fear that they might kill one of their damn trees. Knowing what I know today, I'd been happy to fly right through the middle of them. A bunch of weenies.
Well, do you think that was a safe haven for some of the enemy, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, that's where they hung out. I mean, if they drew fire, or fighters are coming in, they just went into the rubber plantations, and that was off the limits. Absolutely.
I do know that Michelin and some of the other companies did have issue with the United States government if their plantations were damaged.
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Typical French.
Did your unit ever engage in any civic action while you were there?
Yeah, we sponsored an orphanage.
Really?
Uh-huh, and I remember going out to that a couple times. And we also... I think we felt sorry for the people and the fact they had a war in their backyard. You know, they were just trying to live a life, most of them.
What do you remember about leaving Vietnam? when you think back about that?
I was scheduled to leave one day, and I was all set to go, and they canceled the flight. And I've been looking forward to that day for 365 days.
Right.
For some reason, the flight was canceled.
Okay.
So I had to wait another 24 hours, and I was convinced I was going to get killed that 24 hours. It's the first time I ever thought I was going to get really hurt.
Were you waiting at Benoit?
Yeah.
What did you have to go back to your hooch? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say goodbye. I had said goodbye to everybody, and here I come back, you know. Like, guess what? And they all laughed. I had a drink. And we sat there. I think I stayed up all night. I think I slept in the bunker. I'm not sure. But anyhow, the flight left the next day, and that was a great, I mean, it was a great cheer when that thing lifted off.
Yeah. How did it feel getting back stateside?
Great. I still remember seeing my wife and the two little boys. And my oldest boy didn't want to talk to me there, kiss me, because I had a mustache, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He didn't know who I was.
Oh, really?
Plus, I was very dark. I was, you know, I had a lot of sun. And But I did maintain good physical condition over there. I figured if I ever needed to walk out of the jungle or something, that would have made all the difference to me. So I stayed lean and mean over there.
What kind of reception did you have back in the United States at the airports? Did you have any difficulties?
No.
Okay.
No, it was just my wife and kids met me, and we went home.
Okay.
And then the first night, I think I tried to chuck my wife.
Yeah, what difficulties did you have transitioning back out of Vietnam?
The only bad time I ever had was when I'd hear a truck going by and he was shifting gears. It would sound like, oh, it sounded to me like a siren gone off. And I'd be hitting the deck or under the table or something. I'd say, what am I doing? You know, it's crazy. And one of the nights, my first week or two back, I was dreaming that I was fighting somebody. I think it was the guy that I caught stealing from us. And I remember actually choking the guy, not killing him, but choking him into submission. And I ended up doing that to my wife. I scared the hell out of her. And she said, do that again, and I'm out of here, you know. But it really did scare her. But that was the only time that ever happened.
Were those the only PTSD-type incidents that you've ever had?
I guess you had some bad dreams now and then. But
right.
Nothing that I remember.
How much did you discuss your Vietnam experience with other people?
I didn't mind talking about it if they asked me, but I wasn't willing to necessarily introduce the subject.
Did they ask a lot?
Yeah, a lot of people were interested.
Okay.
I found that a lot of my friends, very few of the people that we run with or hang out with or socialize with have ever spent any time, certainly no time in Vietnam. And hardly any time in the military. People just, I don't know, maybe it's the area I'm from or something, but there weren't many people, there aren't many of our friends who really were in the military or know anything about the military.
Do they ask you about it today?
Yeah, from time to time it comes up.
What were your impressions of the anti-war movement?
Well, you can imagine how I feel about that. Just like today when you see these people protesting, they don't know what they're doing. In Vietnam, I can understand toward the end of the war why people would be protesting the war. But the way it was done sometimes, especially by celebrities and people that had influence, I thought it was outrageous when we had kids over there getting shot at, and they're back here protesting. They were only undermining the ability of that soldier or sailor or Marine or Air Force guy to do his job. He's just trying to do what he was supposed to do over there, and we should show the support that those people need. I had no time for those people. If I had ever met one personally, I probably would have had at him. I mean, I had no time for him. Most of them had never fired a shot in anger. Unfortunately, today when I see parades and stuff, and I see even Vietnam vets walking in the parade, they look like a real run-down, raggedy-ass bunch of people. If they're going to wear a uniform, they should wear the whole uniform and look properly, or even just a hat. But the way they dress, you know, with half of a uniform or something, it looks terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see the old guys from World War II, they look distinguished to me. But mm-hmm. the guys from Vietnam, I don't know why. The guys that went over there, fought, did their job, came back, and didn't make a big deal out of it, they don't march in those parades, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the guys are kind of like a raggedy-ass militia is what they look like to me.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the media coverage of the war?
Well, I was there, so I didn't. The only thing I was reading was the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, I don't like the media coverage. I think it's very misrepresentative of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think they're just trying to get their name up on the front page.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the information many of the senior officers were providing them was distorted. I don't think that mm-hmm. statistics and so forth, you could bear that out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we do that, but we didn't need to do that, except for political
mm-hmm.
Gratification. I don't understand it.
Tell me what you think about the political leadership we had during the Vietnam War.
I don't think they knew what they were doing. I mean, I detest Robert McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book, I forget the name of it.
In Retrospect?
Yeah, In Retrospect. I read it cover to cover, and I was frequently reading a book, and I would just scream at, in the middle of a sentence or something. I'd just say, what a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what I think what he was doing is sidestepping his responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how far up the ladder all that went, but I think with a guy like McNamara as the Secretary of Defense, I'm not sure that anybody below him could have controlled things much more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was disreputable. I think he's a liar. I don't think he's a war hero. Country's one of the people we like to look up to, ever.
One of the best and brightest, not one of those.
Oh yeah, he's a smart guy, but mm-hmm. he was smart in business, but he didn't belong in that position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't think that we had the proper leadership. I really did not.
Mm-hmm.
If we did, we would have won the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hands down.
Okay. Did you keep up with the war effort in Vietnam after you came back?
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read everything I could about it. If you ever get a chance to read a book, there's a guy named Lance Sijan, Sijan.
Mm-hmm.
He was an Academy graduate behind me.
Mm-hmm.
He won the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dormitory named after him at the Academy. And an incredible book. I think it's called In the Mouth of the Cat.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a hero. That man was a hero. Mm-hmm. I mean, fantastic. Where do we find people like that? But
mm-hmm.
he was my ideal of the perfect guy who went to the Academy. He excelled at everything he did, and when he went to war to win.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a guy like McNamara calling the shots for a guy like Lance Sijan or any of the other people that had to fight and lost their lives over there, to me, is just despicable.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever get a chance, Richard, read the book.
I will,
Air Force Academy Association, the Alumni Association, can send it to you if you can't find it anywhere else.
Okay. We might have a copy here in the archive, actually. So
you should.
I'll check that out.
Lance Sijan.
Sijan?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. What did you think? Oh, go ahead.
That's okay.
Okay. What did you think of the Vietnamization policy, turning the war over to the Vietnamese? Was that viable to you or not?
The policy specifically, what do you mean?
Just Vietnamizing the war. This was kind of the late Johnson, early Nixon policy of withdrawing Americans, letting the South Vietnamese fight this war for themselves.
Well, they should have been able to deal with it, but they weren't. And, I think at some point we realized we were never going to win the damn thing,
mm-hmm.
not the way it was being fought.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to find a graceful exit, and I don't think we ever found one.
Did we achieve peace with honor?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, just the way it unwound at the end there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was like we didn't achieve peace. We basically got out, and we lost. We didn't achieve what we set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't the military's fault.
Mm-hmm.
It was the civilian leadership and some of the senior officers, some of the senior military leaders,
mm-hmm.
I thought were bullshitting their superiors.
Such as whom?
I really don't. I don't want to get into that.
Okay.
I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, take a guy like Westmoreland. I'm sure he did a lot of good things, but I think he did a lot of things that shouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. How did you feel in 1973 when the United States was completely withdrawn from the country?
I was embarrassed. All the kids we lost over there,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't accomplish diddly squat. And these kids lost their lives. They were only 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a different thing in World War II. Where somebody lost his life. I mean, he was there. He knew why he was there, and he was serving a real purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, we won.
Right.
I don't think the military was empowered enough to win that war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody should have figured that out early on instead of just feeding more and more troops in there.
Mm-hmm.
We were either there to win it or get the hell out to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's easy to say in retrospect, but I don't think McNamara ever got the picture. And I'm not sure Nixon or Johnson ever did either.
How did you feel in April 1975 when Saigon fell? Do you remember where you were?
No. I don't remember where I was.
Do you remember how you felt?
I felt terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like, my God, how could we have lost that? You know?
Mm-hmm.
How can a great nation like America succumb to something like that in a war so far away? I guess we lost our focus on what we were really there for.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we were also, we underestimated the enemy
mm-hmm.
tremendously.
Yeah. Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the war?
Yeah, I think so.
Like what?
Well, you know, you say that today, I would say offhand that don't get involved in something unless you intend to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking at what we're doing right now is
mm-hmm.
a similar situation. I endorse what's going on now because I think we're dealing with another Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with a very evil guy in the Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just brutalized his own people, let alone his neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to be removed. But unfortunately, we didn't have very much support internationally. But so what? We'll do it. And I don't think we're going to back away. I think we're going to go
mm-hmm.
until we win it.
Mm-hmm.
And we will win it. And it will be quick.
Mm-hmm.
I think the aftermath will be tough. You know, setting up another government
mm-hmm.
and trying to ever institute democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to solve the Palestinian-Israeli problem, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we're the ones that have to do all this, but I guess we are.
Do you think that the lessons learned in Vietnam affect our policy in the Middle East today, or what's happening now, or what happened in the first Gulf War?
To a degree, I guess. I couldn't quote you a specific place where I can show you where we learned
mm-hmm.
a lesson there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we definitely are conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we're going to repeat the mistake or not, I can't tell you. I don't think we will, but...
Right.
And I don't necessarily classify Vietnam as a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I think our intentions were good when we went in.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we weren't enabled to win.
Mm-hmm.
We never had a chance to win.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today?
I'm proud of it. I felt like, you know, I answered a call and I went and I did my job and I didn't back away.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would change about your experience, if you could?
I don't think so, necessarily. I mean, the things that I was able to control, I controlled,
mm-hmm.
and I did the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in charge of any great bunch of people, but the people that I did, what my responsibilities were, I think I fulfilled them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think I did it to the best of my ability.
What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there?
In Vietnam?
Yes, sir.
that we're very lucky to have a country like we have. Mm-hmm. People suffer a lot in this world, and we don't have a clue sometimes. And unfortunately, I think Americans have become, I don't know how to describe it exactly. I'm very disappointed sometimes when I see the trash that we put on the television and stuff and the kids, what kids are exposed to today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think we've lost some of the morality that this country was based on.
Mm-hmm.
We could certainly, if I had my way, I'd like to get rid of some of this trash that comes across the network.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see our people get educated again and read the newspaper and have an opinion based on something, not just something they happen to hear on a news network.
Mm-hmm.
People have to get involved if they want. I mean, they don't seem, I think we seem more concerned with our own little lives than we do with the country that we live in sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And our kids are our responsibility. And you take a look at the schools and some of the lack of parental discipline today. And I'm just wondering what kind of generation of people we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, Clinton was a classic example to me, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
He was a disreputable jerk, and people voted for him. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was embarrassed by that guy.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the war has most affected your life overall?
I don't think it affected it too much, except that my wife had to endure a tough year.
Mm-hmm.
But she was tough going in, she was tough coming out. So we're still married after 41 years, I guess. Because it was okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's affected my life a lot, one way or another.
Okay. You mentioned the one book that you recommended, Sijon's book. Any other books that you've read on Vietnam that you think are worthwhile? Or do you read books on Vietnam?
I don't read much on Vietnam. I guess I got tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the movies I've seen in Vietnam I didn't like.
The movies that you saw in Vietnam or about Vietnam?
About Vietnam.
Okay.
I think they characterize the American soldier as a drug-smoking, pot-smoking young fool out in the jungle. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the way it was necessarily. I think some of those kids ended up doing that because they didn't have the proper leadership or direction,
mm-hmm.
quite honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would have done just fine if they had been given the proper leadership training and direction out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they were dealing with an enemy they didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I was the vice president of flight operations for Airborne Express
mm-hmm.
out in Ohio for 7 years. And I had a captain that flew for me out there. He was a real interesting guy. His name was Roger Moose.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been a young squadron leader in the Army, in the infantry,
mm-hmm.
in the war. And he almost got shot to death. He got shot through the neck and some corpsman dragged him back and put some morphine in his butt, and the guy had a live hand grenade in his hand. He had just pulled the pin. He was going to throw it.
Mm.
And the corpsman realized it somehow, took the hand grenade out, got rid of it, and saved this guy's life.
Mm.
And now he is permanently affected from the war, I can assure you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his wife told me some of the stories. He used to sleep with a .45 under his pillow at night. He shot a shirt that she had ironed and hung up one time because he thought it was an intruder. I mean, he seems to have settled down. I think he had an uncle who straightened him out. He came back from the war and was just a crazy man. He was getting in fights all the time, raising hell. Anyhow, somebody straightened him out along the line, but he was affected by the war,
mm-hmm.
no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the kids, once again, that they went over there and fought the war, and they came back, and they weren't able to ever say we won. You know,
mm-hmm.
I went over there and I smoked pot. Or people look at them and say, "Well, you know, you didn't succeed over there. You didn't do what you were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't their fault." It doesn't bother me. I think I was old enough to realize what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we did what we could do, but the limited things that we had and the way we had to fight the war, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm not ashamed at all of my service over there.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Vietnam today?
Well, here we are, you know. McCain says, let's go back and make friends with them and juice up their economy. Hey, we won the Cold War, and I think that Vietnam was affected a lot by China, no question about it, and the support they got from Russia and China. I guess they're doing fine today.
Okay.
It just seems wacko. I mean, it seems crazy, doesn't it? Exactly how it evolved, but I mean, I hope they're happy. I hope that it's a prosperous country. They seem to be. I'm not sure I want to go back and see it again just to try to remember stuff. I don't want to do it for that reason. But I wouldn't mind going back just to see how the country's doing. But I don't go back to try to remember what happened to me there.
Do you know any of your, or have you, well, I've already asked if you've kept in touch with these guys, and you kind of have, not too much, but I was going to ask, have you heard of other veterans going back to Vietnam and your impression of that journey?
Nobody that I know. I've just seen, I've seen some movie clips of a guy going back, and it was, I think, good for him to do that. But I don't know that I would react one way or the other going back there.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
No. Not by intent or lack of intent, but
right.
Just hasn't happened.
Have you been to the wall in Washington?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell me about that experience?
Yeah, I cried when I was there. Because it brought a lot of memories back of guys who did die. And you look at that, I don't know, 56,000 or whatever, and the wall is a beautiful tribute to them, and having their name there, and seeing the people there that are tracing the name or just looking or touching the wall, you know there's a lot of grief that people are dealing with. Because I think it's a very fitting and beautiful tribute to those people.
What would you tell young people today about the Vietnam War?
Well, if they asked me, I would tell them what my experience was and that we fought the war wrong, improperly. I don't think our being there initially was wrong, but I think the way we conducted the war was entirely wrong. And then it wasn't fair to the troops that we sent over there. But that doesn't mean I'd be out marching in the street while the troops are over there. I wouldn't, ever. And I would be more interested in what they think. What does Vietnam think? Do they know anything about Vietnam? Do they know anything about World War II? Do they know what this country went through in the Civil War? I mean, we have a long history of wars. Not necessarily ones we started, but we ended up the winner. And we'll win this one. This is a weird one we're in now. We're dealing with, like, phantoms, but we're going to win. I know we are. Now I'm just talking about Iraq. I'm talking about the, you know, the whole terrorist threat that we're facing today.
The war on terrorism.
Right.
Okay.
But I'd be happy to answer their questions, you know, and I've done that. My daughter was in a school out in Cincinnati, and they were studying Vietnam in a history course, and they asked Roger Moosen, well, they asked me if I would come in and talk about the war, and I invited Roger to come with me. And we talked to the kids for a while. And, I mean, they had no clue what we were talking about.
What grade were they?
11th or 12th graders.
Okay, high schoolers.
Yeah. But they were interested enough to take the course. So I felt like, hey, here it is. This is what it was like. And depending where you were, what you did, it looked a lot different. And I'll never forget that young Marine. I'll just never forget him.
Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Only, Richard, that I think it's a great idea that whoever it was that started this, to try to put Vietnam in perspective. It's gotten so much bad press from the wrong people who don't know diddly squat about what really happened. And they've never stopped to appreciate what some of the kids went through over there. I mean, we lost damn near a generation of young people, not a generation, but certainly a large percentage of that generation.
Mm-hmm.
And we came away with bitter memories that we didn't win the war.
Right.
And, the inevitable question is, why didn't we win it? And I think kids should be aware of that. We've won some incredible wars,
mm-hmm.
only because we made a national commitment to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be a national commitment.
You think that's the key to it?
Yes.
Okay.
But you know what? You can't always get everybody aboard, just like today.
Mm-hmm.
You can't always get all the citizens behind you. I mean, it'd be great if you could. Now, I think if there was another severe, significant terrorist act that they could define that Iraq was responsible for,
mm-hmm.
I don't think there'd be any question.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I don't expect my president and this administration or any other administration to make every possible piece of information available to me that they have,
mm-hmm.
as far as intelligence.
Right.
Because, I mean, that would basically reveal the source of the intelligence and probably dry it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't feel like they have to tell me everything that's going on. I have to trust in them.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I didn't, and I did vote for Bush, but even if I hadn't voted for him, I still have to believe he will do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly got some smart people helping them.
Yes, sir.
And I have to believe in that. And I don't believe people standing out in the street with a little bit of misinformation, although they have the right to say so. I don't think they've got the smarts to be able to tell us what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're entitled to their opinion, but hey, we're going to do what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have a clue of the fact what we've had to do to give them the right to stand out there, I don't think they even have a clue about that, quite
mm-hmm.
frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing that really perturbs me the most is when I see media people, I like Hollywood actors and actresses standing up because they've got the visibility.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people actually believe, I guess they really are president or something. I mean, they just are so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
If they really were articulate and knew what they had a good case, hey, great, that's what makes this country great. You know, we have different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes time to go to war, and this goes for Daschle, too, quite honestly,
mm-hmm.
when we've got troops in the field going to war, it's not the time for some jerk like Daschle to be making derogatory comments about why our troops are there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you ask me.
I appreciate your opinion very much. Okay, was there anything else you want to talk about, sir?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay.
I haven't thought about this stuff and 30 years.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us, and we'll go ahead and end the interview with Colonel Robert Fisher. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, Richard. Thank you.